Oh, yes, indeed. Who knows the evil? Who knows, I repeat, who knows the evil that lurks in the hearts of men? Who was it who wrote that? Who was that? Was that Earl Wilson?
Ed Sullivan?
No. Walter Winter? No. But suffice it to say, friends, only he who knows evil knows the evil that lurks in the hearts of men. In addition to that, life is just a milkshake. You're going to have a deep philosophy there. I knew it would come to this. I knew that I would finally get you in my clutches. I know that it had to happen. For nothing. It's just coming out of that cheap little radio of yours, and there's nothing you can do about it. Well, you can turn it off. I dare you. I dare you, you. I dare you. And so it came to pass that once again, Halloween-een. Or is this a... No, is this Halloween Eve, or... No, this is just Halloween. Halloween has finally arrived. Do you know that in certain cities, Halloween is celebrated as a major holiday? That in Cincinnati, for example, thousands of people, they close off the whole, all the streets on, oh, it's about 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, just about this time. And thousands of people gather in the middle of town, all dressed in costumes, and they form a line, like an enormous conga line of the entire city. And they march, I mean, up and down the streets for mile after mile. You see millions of people on Halloween Eve. It's a kind of mid-fall Mardi Gras in Cincinnati. And all they do on Halloween out here in New York City is write obscenities on your windshield with wax. And that's about the extent of it. But, you know, have you noticed that more and more in the last year or two, people have begun to drift closer to a peculiar kind of belief in witchcraft. Now, I'm not being funny. I'm being very serious about this. I'm not at all being funny, and I'm not talking about the witches that constantly pop up in TV commercials, you know, the one that shows up with the white tornado or the little thing with the wand and she with the Ajax and she touches the sink and it gets clean, although you find a lot of that going on. But have you noticed that more and more people are taking witches and the occult, astrology, they're taking all this jazz more and more serious. And I read a quotation from Edward Gibbon not long ago, and Gibbon is the guy who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, or The Decline of the Roman Empire. And he made the point that as Rome began to decline, superstition rose to unparalleled heights. Did you know that, Al? The superstition in Rome, just about the time when Rome was beginning to finally go under and become just a tourist trap, that people began to believe in all kinds of wild superstitions. And he said the belief in ghosts and one thing or another began to be noticeable on all sides. And you could see that happening. Have you noticed that now they're doing big TV spectaculars on a seance. You notice that?
Oh, yeah.
And if this continues, I see the day when every president will have his personal medium to contact the other world. Because after all, why should such great military geniuses, say, Hannibal, be allowed to be wasted? And so the president will call in his medium and say, figure out a vast pincers movement on the enemy. Would you please put me in touch, put me through to Hannibal? And then the medium will go into a trance. You know, they're always going to try to go, they fall down, you know, they bring out the purple lights, and the bugles start blowing, flap, 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 and then suddenly, out of the air conditioning comes a ghostly voice. I am Hannibal. Why are you disturbing my peace? Mr. Hannibal, I'm the President of the United States. And we would like to work out a pincers movement on the enemy, and we understand that you're a pretty good man with the military tactics, right?
Yes, in my time, I was considered the outstanding military genius in hack, executive conch, in hospital lock.
Aha! Uh-huh. Well, please keep it in English there. I don't speak none of them foreign languages, but it's very good. Hannibal... what do you say about overextending your supply lines? We got a little problem about supply lines.
I say that he that extendeth his supply lines beyond logical, reasonable lengths, he asks for a military disaster. Better shorten your supply lines, buddy. You're running them out too long. And incidentally, another thing, I'd suggest that you get more half tracks at work. I've been watching your...
Oh, it's got to come. It's got to come. And, yes, of course. And every major building, every major corporation, you know, for a few years back, there's psychiatry's out now. That's one of the great out scientists. Psychiatry's out, and psychologists are as dead as you know what's. And they really are. They're dead. They've gone the way of the alchemist. On all sides now, people are laughing. And so, a few years ago, if you remember, every major company had its resident psychiatrist. And so if the head of the promotion department flipped his wig, they just run him down to the 28th floor and they, plunk him on a couch there for a while. And they'd find out what's bugging him. They'd find out where his repressions were becoming a little too strenuous and his aggressions were getting out. And they'd throw him back in the fight. He's okay. But now that's dead. And I say that every major company will have its resident astrologer. And so before a big sales promotion, I can just see it here at WR, you know, before a big sales promotion, Mr. Smith gets on the phone, he calls in the astrologer, and Bob Husey is called in, they call in Herb Saltzman, you know, and Bob Alden, the whole crowd. And they walk into this room. And this room, of course, there'll be an astrologer's room, you know, just like in the old days when they had the psychiatrists. They used to have a psychiatrist's room, and it had a certain look about it. They always had old American furniture and heavy leather couches, and they had pictures of skating scenes by Currier and Ives. You see, it was all designed to soothe the troubled breast. And you'd come in and... They had the, yeah, very important when you're doing, you know, psychiatry work, whole shtick. And usually somewhere along the line, there was a frame hanging on the wall with a diploma with a great big gold seal on it. That's very totemistic. That really used to get the poor, you know, the poor wackos going. They'd see that and they know they were in the presence of officialdom. But that's going to, of course, have to be carried out in the astrologer world. And so they will pile into a darkened room, and there will be purple drapes hanging all around, everywhere. And the astrologer does not just sit at a desk. The astrologer makes an entrance and wears one of those high-peaked hats, You know, the kind that Merlin wears with moons all over it and stars and bells and little jazz like that and a long purple robe, the whole business. And they'll all come in, and Mr. Smith will sit at the desk there, at the big teakwood desk. It's carved with symbols, of course. Because magic is very important. Nobody really knows how anything works, you know. It's all considered magic, Dave, underneath it all. We use the word all the time, like the magic of Johnny Carson, the magic of Ed Sullivan. So, you know, there's no real answer to these things. So the desk is carved with little moons and jazz like that. And Mr. Smith says, Mr. Swami, we would like to ask you, how does the month of December look for our operation uprating? We've got operation there to raise all the ratings. What we're going to do is we're going to teach all the various performers on the station to sing the company song. And we're going to open it up with the company song. We have a little rock and roll thrown in. Al McCann is going to get a little group. It's going to be called Al McCann and his Striped Bass, and they're going to play down at the Jilly's place, and, you know, they can work. And we're trying to boost the rating. What does it look like to you? And then the Swami says, he's looking at his charts, you see, phonology. The seventh phase of Mercury is in direct conflict from December 2nd on to the 13th of January, is in direct conflict with the fourth phase of Arcturus, the third Pleiades statute, as it moves into the great cosmos area and into the shadow of Orion the Grape. Do you realize what this means? Forget it. That is WNEW weather. So I suggest that we fire the sales department and lay low till February. I have spoken. Let me tell you, don't think that wouldn't make sense to a lot of people around here. Everything else has failed. We tried it all, you know. And so tonight, we are about to celebrate. Speak your failures. We're going to have their big. That reminds me, this is WOR, New York. And, one more thing here. I've got the... Oh, yes. Before we go anything else here, Friday, November 3rd, at 8 o'clock, and don't say I didn't warn you, Friday, November 3rd, there's going to be a gigantic event entitled An Evening with Gene Shepherd. Gee, I'd like to spend one of them evenings. It's an evening with Gene Shepherd at Randolph High School at 8 p.m., Millbrook, Mount Freedom Road. Now, why don't you get right down to the basic here? Randolph High School in Dover, New Jersey. If you live out around Dover, New Jersey, heaven help you. But if you live out around Dover, New Jersey, we're going to be at Randolph High School on the Millbrook Mount Freedom Road, February, November 3rd at 8 o'clock. And the tickets are available at the door. And the benefit is for the Randolph High School Scholarship Fund, whatever that may be. And that's Randolph High School. I wonder what Randolph they're named after. Oh, that's very good. Randolph Scott? Maybe? Oh, sure, no kidding. You know, are you aware that out in Minnesota, I believe it is, there is a Joe Palooka High School? Sorry. Absolutely sorry that more and more we're beginning to name things after mythological creatures. That they're very important. I believe there is a town. I don't want to deviate from the subject here, but you know that there's a town in Arizona that was named after an old radio television show? I believe it's Arizona. And periodically, the townspeople get mad and march on the city hall to try to change the name of it. And believe it or not, it's called Truth or Consequences. Truth or Consequences, Arizona. Did you ever hear about that? Well, I mean, there's a nuttiness is extant. So what's the matter with Joe Palooka High School? That's like Hit the Ding Dong, Indiana, you know? you know, or Allen Ludden, Iowa. Oh, boy. But there's all kinds of... Speaking of the supernatural, friends, listen, you buy my paperback book or I'll hit you. But I'm delighted to report that In God We Trust, did you see that, Alan? In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, has been on the bestseller list now for the past month in New York City. And that's in paperbacks. And we're pleased, you know, and delighted that we not only passed in the Valley of the Dolls, if you can imagine that, we actually topped the Passover plot. And do that in New York. You're doing some topping. And that's In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash, and it's on Bantam. And if you walk into your drugstore and the guy says, I only carry dirty books, well, you tell him, look at chapter 12, the second page, the third paragraph from the bottom, okay? That's In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. Now, would you please sneak that in? I need this little bit here. Sneak it in. It's Halloween night. And boy, do I have some memories about this night. You know that there's a whole body of poetry been written about Halloween? I will read to you. On Halloween, I'll go to town and wear my trousers upside down and wear my shoes turned inside out and wear a wig of sauerkraut. That's Shelley Silverstein. Oh, but this is even a better one. Listen to this one. The hag is astride this night. The hag is astride this night for to ride the devil and she together through thick and thin, now out and then in, through ne'er so foul be the weather. A thorn or a burr she takes for a spur with a lash of a bramble. She rides now through brakes, through briars, over ditches and mires. She follows the spirit that guides now. No beast for his food dares now range the wood, but hushed in his lair he lies lurking, while mischiefs by these on land and on seas at noon of night are a-working. The storm will arise and will trouble the skies this night, and more for the wonder, because the ghost from the tomb affrighted shall come, called out by the clap of the thunder. Who raps at my window? Who in a white sheet runs across the midnight lawn without the sound of feet? Huh? What moon grows in the east so huge and dusky red? Who howls from the chill within the hill where the farmer's hound lies dead? The dry leaves twist and rattle, alive in an evil spell. And down by the pond, the man who drowned tolls a wavering bell. The wind has hardly wakened, yet flapping through the air fly shapes with wings and bony things and forms with jagged hair. Who blows at my candle? Whose fiery grin and eyes behind me pass in the looking glass and make my goose flesh rise? Who moved in that shadow? Who rustles past unseen? With the dark so deep, I dare not sleep all night on Halloween. That's not bad, is it? Listen to this one. This is called a Halloween indignation meeting. A sulky witch and a surly cat and a scowly owl and a skeleton sat with a grouchy ghost and a waspish bat and angrily snarled and chewed the fat. It seems that they were all upset and riled that they could not frighten the modern child, who was much too knowing and much too wild and considered Halloween spooks too mild, said the witch, and we quote, they call this the human race. Yet the kiddies occupy outer space. They bob for comets and eat ice cream from flying saucers to get up steam. I'm a shade of my former self, said the skeleton. I shiver and shake like so much gelatin. Indeed, I'm a pitiful sight to see. I'm scareder of kids than they are of me. Yes, and here's
one of the great classics of all time. From ghoulies and ghosties, long-leggedy beasties and things that go bump in the night. Good Lord, deliver us.
That's a great classic. That one more than any, I think, has hung around. And you know, now, and I want to be serious here for a minute. You know, you listen and you kind of laugh at all this stuff of ghosts and ghoulies and things that go bump in the night. Yet, man, ever since the very, probably one of the things that set man aside from all the other creatures is his fear of the unseen things. Now, whatever they might be, I mean, you know, he's invented them. But that doesn't matter. That makes them even more evil, the fact that he has created them. And, you know, you can almost see the first scene. You know, you don't ever see camels standing there talking to each other. And one camel says, I don't know. There's something behind that bush. Never. You won't see, even though, you know, people have a tendency to believe that dogs do this. No. But any time a dog's hair rises on the back of his neck, it's because he smells something. He's heard a sound that maybe you can't hear, because his ears, you know, go way up higher in frequency than the human ears. And so he's heard something scratch, or he's heard the wind blow through something, and it's made a high-pitched squeal, which you can't even detect. And his fur goes up. He looks around. He goes, and people have a tendency to say, now, you see, he's aware of unseen things. Not necessarily. He hears things. He smells things at you. But they're physical, really. It's only man, like Edgar Allan Poe, only man could conceive of a raven sitting there up on the sill, dark and forbidding, and saying only, nevermore. Nevermore, quoth the raven, nevermore. And the tintinnabulation of the bells. And this is what sets us apart, among other things. It's what created the devil. And almost every, and I won't be too general here about this, but almost every society that we have ever studied, that man has ever looked at, has its version of the dark side of the moon, that evil thing, whatever it might be. And you feel it yourself. I don't think there's a man with soul so dead who never to himself has said when he goes into the dark garage, holy smokes. I mean, what is he afraid of? He doesn't know, you know. He has no idea what he's afraid of. Now, if you say, are you afraid of a short guy with pimples hiding there back where you keep the old used tires and he's got a wrench in his hand, he's going to hit you on the head? No, not that specific. It's the dark. And I can imagine one of the great turning points came in man's history when these two cavemen in primordial times, long before history was ever even conceived as an abstract science, back in the days when they didn't even have a sky, like we know now. It was all gray from horizon to horizon. They had not even yet invented trees. There was nothing but the eternal gray and the eternal black. And Og and Charlie, but a few millennia, had crawled from the dark Stygian waters of the ancient lake from whence we all sprung. And now they sit, crouched, hunched, their beady red-rimmed eyes peering out at the blackening world from the mouth of their cave, and the wind howls through the rocks. Eon after eon they sit, age after age, Og
is replaced by Og.
Charlie is replaced by Charlie. And the pile of bones grows thicker and deeper at the end of the cave wherein lay the cast-off selves of former incarnations. And from the far-off hill, on the horizon that stretches all the way to the gray sky, occasionally is heard the keening of a hunting wolf.
And Og and Charlie scrunch down even lower out of the wind as that heavy, hard, cold breeze ruffles the hair on the back of their necks. And then the turning point had to happen. The turning point that changed man from beast into man. That changed this poor, crawling, sniveling creature from a beast of the field to the scourge of the cosmos. Just as it was turning dark, one long day, eons passed, Og gripped for the first time by an emotion that mankind forever hence would feel. But he for the first felt it, gripped by an emotion that came rising out of the fog of his unformed psyche, like some great iceberg out of an Arctic sea. Cold, clammy. His two beady eyes narrow as he stares at a clump of rocks 100 yards away down towards the shore. Great shadows hang like pendulous blots on the darkening clay that extends to the very edge of the water itself. The wind howls. The wolf screams in the forest. Ow! And suddenly, Og.
Me, Gazi, it was you.
He speaks to Charlie. Charlie turns slowly, because reaction times were not very fast then. He turns slowly and says,
what you were.
Translated means, what did you say?
Og repeats, what is it, Og, here?
Meaning, there is something over there. There is something in the dark, in that shadow. What is it? It was the first time that elusive feeling was felt. It was the very first time, but far from the last. Yeah. Now, how do you like that? Eh? Does that make any sense to you? Yes, it does. Teletest. Yes, it does. In fact, I'm about now to read a poem to you that more than any other poem I've read in a long time captures that sneaky, sneaky feeling of there's something out there in the dark. Now, if you will please sneak that up there. You put it on there? All right. Now, wait till you hear this one now. Just hold on. You ready now? You better send the kids to bed. This is a beautiful poem. One of my favorites. And I read it to you now. Slowly, silently, now the moon walks the night in her silver shoon. This way and that, she peers and sees silver fruit upon silver trees. One by one, the casements catch her beams beneath the silvery thatch. crouched in his kennel like a log, with paws of silver, sleeps the dog. From their shadowy coat, the white breasts peep, of doves in a silver-feathered sleep. A harvest mouse goes scampering by, with silver claws and silver eye. And moveless fish in the water gleam by silver reeds in a silver stream. Isn't that a beautiful poem? That darkness. Yeah, and here's one by the same poet, Walter de la Mare. When Sam goes back in memory, it is to where the sea breaks on the shingle, emerald green, in white foam, endlessly. He says with small brown eyes on mine, I used to keep awake and lean from my windows in the moon watching those billows break. And half a million tiny hands and eyes like sparks of frost would dance and come tumbling into the moon on every breaker tossed. And all across from star to star, I've seen the watery sea with not a single ship in sight. Just ocean. Just ocean there. And me. And heard my father snore. And once, as sure as I'm alive, out of those wallowing, moon-flecked waves, I saw a mermaid dive, head and shoulders above the wave, plain as I see you now, combing her hair, now back, now front, her two eyes peeping through, calling me, Sam, quiet-like, Sam. With me, I never went, making believe I kind of thought 'twas someone else she meant. Wonderful lovely, there she sat, singing the night away, all in the solitudinous sea of that there lonely bay. Perhaps, and he'd smooth his hairless mouth, perhaps if 'twere now, my son, perhaps if I heard a voice say, Sam, morning would find me gone. Yeah. Listen to this beauty. This is a lovely poem about that strange fear that we all know. I know some lonely houses off the road, a robber'd like the look of, wooden barred and windows hanging low, inviting to a portico where two could creep, one hand the tools, the other peep to make sure all's asleep. Old-fashioned eyes, not easy to surprise. How orderly the kitchen had looked by night, with just a clock. But they could gag the tick, and mice won't bark. And so the walls don't tell. None will. A pair of spectacles ajar, just stir. An almanac's aware. Was it the map that winked? Or a nervous star? The moon slides down the stair to see who's there. There's plunder. Where? Tankard or spoon, earring or stone, a watch, some ancient brooch, to match the grandmama, stayed, sleeping there. Day rattles too, stealth slow, the sun has got as far as the third sycamore, screams Chanticleer, who's there? And echoes, trains away, sneer, where? While the old couple, just astir, fancy the sunrise, left the door ajar. Who wrote that? Emily Dickinson. That's a sneaky one, yeah. Listen to this one. I am out on the wind in the wild black night. On the wings of the owl I take my flight. On the ghostly wings of the great white owl. And whether the night be fair or foul, or the moon be up, or the thunder growl, happy I be. Happy I be when the changeling blood runs green in me. When meek folk sleep in their dull, soft beds, I creep over roots that the weasel treads, where the squat green lamps of the toadstools glow, and only the fox knows the ways I go, and nobody knows the things I know. Wise I be. Wise I be when the changeling blood runs green in me. Oh, mother, slumber, do not awake. thin voices call from the rain-wet break. And the child you cradled against your breast is out in the night on the black wind's crest. For only the wild can give me rest. Sad I be. Sad I be when the changeling blood runs green in me. Yeah. You want to hear some more of these? These are magnificent, some of these. Because I think some of the greatest poems, you know, people keep thinking that poetry is always about love. You know, most people say the great poetry is about love. I think some of the greatest poetry in the world has been written about fear. Listen to this one now. Here's another interesting piece of business by a famous German poet. Under the linden, the music is gay, the couples are gossiping loudly, and two are dancing, whom nobody knows. They carry themselves so proudly. Now here, now there, they glide and sway and wave like measures, beguiling. They bow to each other, and as they nod, she whispers, gently smiling. A water pink is hanging from your cap, my fair young dancer. It only grows in the depths of the sea. You are no mortal man, sir. You are a merman. And to lure these village maids, your wish is, I knew you at once by your watery eyes and your teeth as sharp as the fish's. Oh, yes, now here, now there, they glide and sway in wave-like measures, beguiling. They bow to each other. And as they nod, he answers, gently smiling. Oh, my lovely lady. Tell me why your hand's so cold and shiny, and why is the border of your gown so damp and draggled and briny? I knew you at once by your watery eyes and your bow so mocking and tricksy. You're never a daughter of earth, my dear. You're my cousin, a Nixie. The fiddles are silent. The dancing is done. They part with a ripple of laughter. They know each other too well. And we'll try to avoid such a meeting hereafter. Here's another famous one. How much time do I have? Oh, okay. Here's one. Here's a beautiful one. And by the way, this has been set to music. And the music that it's set to is an Elizabethan lament. And I've heard it once or twice. It's quite rare. But listen to this one. Drank lonesome water. Weren't but a tad then, up in a laurel thick, digging for sang. Come on a place where the stones was holler. Something below them tinkled and rang. Dug where I heard it, dripping below me. Should have known better, should have been wise. Leaned down and drank it, clutching and gripping the overhang cliff with the ferns in my eyes. Twerent no tame water, I knowed in a minute. Must have been laying there, projecting around some winter, went home. Must have laid like a cushion where the feet of the blossoms was tucked in the ground. It tasted of heart leaf. And that smells the sweetest, pawpaw and spice bush and wild briar rose. Must have been counting the heels of the spruce pines and neighboring around where angelica grows. I drunk lonesome water. I knowed in a minute. Never learnt nothing from then till today. Nothing worth learning. Nothing worth knowing. I'm bound to the hills and can't get away. Mean, sort of dried up old groundhoggy fella laying out cold here, watching the sky poor as a whippoorwill, bent like a grass blade, counting up stars till they count too high. I know where the gray foxes uses up yander. Know what of cure ye of physic or chills, but I never been away from here. Never got going. I've drunk lonesome water. I'm bound to the hills. Isn't that a sad one? That one line, never got going. I've drunk lonesome water. Boy, maybe that answers your questions why you never got moving. No, these are about real things, you know. Listen to this one. This is called The Ghost That Jim Saw. This is another old American classic.
And it's written, by the way, it was written by a great American poet. Why, as to that, said the engineer, ghosts ain't things we're apt to fear. Spirits don't fool with levers much, and throttle valves don't take to such. And as for Jim, what happened to him was one half fact and the other half whim. Running one night on the line, he saw a house as plain as the moral law just by the moonlit bank. And thence, out came a drunken man with no more sense than to drop right on the rail, flat as a flail, as Jim drove by with the midnight mail. Down went the patent, steam reversed. Too late! There came a thud. Jim cursed as the fireman there in the cab with him kind of stared in the face of Jim and says, "What now?" Says Jim, "What now? I've just run over a man, that's how." The fireman stared at Jim. They ran back, but never found house nor man, never a shadow within a mile. Jim turned pale, but he tried to smile. Then on he tore, 10 miles or more, in quicker time than he'd ever made before. Would you believe it? The very next night, up rose that house in the moonlight, white. Out comes the chap and drops just as before. Down goes the brake, and the rest, encore. And so, in fact, each night, that act occurred until Forbes swore that Jim was cracked. Let me see, it's a year now, most, that I met Jim, east, out in the east, and he says, "How's your ghost?" "Gone," said Jim. "And more, it's plain that ghost don't trouble me again. I thought I shook that ghost when I took a place on an eastern line. But look, what should I meet the first trip out but the very house we talked about and the selfsame man?" "Well," says I guess it's time to stop this here foolishness." So I crammed down the steam, and there come a scream from my fireman that just broke my dream. "You killed somebody," says I. "Not much. I've been there often, and there ain't no such, and I'll prove it." Back we ran. And darn my skin, but there was a man on the rail dead, smashed in the head. Now, I call that meanness, is all that Jim could say. That was written by Bret Hart. And way down deep in the darkness of the soul of the man, as he walks along 49th Street with the wind howling out over the devilish river, screaming out over the eternal, over the horizon and over the waves, the call of the Lorelei. Who knows what evil lies in the hearts of men? But I say to you, friend, as I've said so many times, trick or treat. And by the way, yeah, I did a terrible thing today in the bank, Al. I walked in right up to my teller, and I said, "Trick or treat." He looked at me and says, "What do you expect me to give you?" I said, "Guess. Trick or treat." And he says, "Well, what if I said trick?" And with that, I whipped out a .44. I got the candy. Now bring it up there big, friends. And out there in the darkness, out there. Oh, heck, it's just a cap. I mean, who cares? And you know, that's exactly what Charlie said to Og. "It's just a saber-toothed tiger." Og said, no, it's something else. I can't quite figure it out." And there you had the two of them right there from the very beginning. The skeptic and the believer. The skeptic and the believer. And who's right? Well, keep your knees loose, and you better be hoping that you're betting on the right side, friends. You better be hoping.